Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 70 of Real Blend, a podcast that is fairly confident that Jake is a British citizen now.
Jake, how annoyed would you be if I did the entire podcast with a British accent?
I challenge you to actually try to do that. I would assume your British accent is fairly convincing, too.
I don't know. If anything, it's probably borderline offensive, if anything. Yeah, I'm not Madonna, so I probably shouldn't try to fake a British accent.
I want to point out, for people who might have missed it, go back and listen to last week's episode, because Jake's Texas accent comes out a lot over the course of, that episode. I picked up on it a number of times. This is episode number 70, a nice round number and an action-packed show that is coming to you guys this week. We have Ma and Rocket Man talk. We're going to talk about The Perfection, that Netflix movie that was out there. We are going to have a very special interview later on this episode with Rocket Man producer Matthew Vaughn. And we've been told going into the interview that we can talk all things X-Men with him and the Kingsman franchise. And of course, his journey to bring Rocket Man to the big screen. But we are down one man this week with Big Daddy Kev on vacation. So that leaves myself, Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and my brother in blending, Jake Hamilton, of Fox 32 in Chicago, holding down the fort. Jake, start by telling people where you are, and we will get to stories about why you are there in a minute.
Before I do that, did we ever discuss bringing Gabe on as the third person, or was that just blown aside?
No. Yeah, never. Never an option.
Never an option.
Well, here's why. I'm tired of throwing that out there as like a tease, as like a hook kind of thing, because you can only pull the football away from me so many times, Lucy, before I just stop offering it, right? So it's just you and I today.
See, that's what we should do. We should start telling him he's not allowed on the show, and then he'll want to be on the show.
There was a moment in last week's show, to tear down the curtain a little bit, where Gabe punched into the show, and we thought it was like an official, like he's chiming in, but he was really just letting us know that, like, I'm going to cut this later, but you guys are doing something wrong. But I was excited for a minute there. All right, where are you?
I am in Liverpool, England, which is, if you're unfamiliar with the geography of England, it's about a couple of hours north of London. And I'm here because Liverpool, if you don't know, is the home of the Beatles. John Lennon, Paul McCartney grew up just a couple of miles away from where I'm sitting right now. Strawberry awesome. Fields is just a couple of blocks away from where I am right now. Penny Lane is just a couple of blocks away from where I am. And I'm here because I'm going to interview Danny Boyle and Richard Curtis and Lily James and the newcomer. I forget his name. Himesh Patel, I think his name is.
I believe that's it. Yeah, I believe
that's it. For the new movie Yesterday, which if you're not familiar with it, the entire premise, which I think is a really clever premise, is a guy gets into an accident and wakes up in the hospital. And he's the only person who remembers the Beatles. And I think it's a really cool premise. I love Richard Curtis. I think his screenplays are fantastic. I think About Time is some truly underrated work. Love Actually is amazing. And then pairing up with Danny Boyle, I think, is a really, really interesting pairing. Because, you know, they each have made very quintessential British movies, but almost on opposite sides of the track. If you look at Four Weddings and a Funeral and Trainspotting, they came out around the same time, but they could not be more different about what it means to have like the British experience. So I'll be curious to see what happens when you put those two together.
And you haven't seen the movie yet?
I have not. I see it in just a couple of hours. But I'm a big Beatles fan, and I think it's a really clever premise, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, well, before we get into reviews, then, I just want to talk about Liverpool, because you actually just went on a really cool tour. Is it like an official Beatles tour, or did someone just sort of take you guys around?
Yeah, someone just kind of took us around, because you know, what's so funny is that everything's just kind of there. And maybe it's because it's a Wednesday afternoon, and it's kind of that quintessential British weather where it's kind of gloomy and a little drizzly, but each place we went to, there really wasn't anyone there. It was very sort of low key. I mean, like, I expected to have to fight the crowds at Strawberry Field, and it's really, there wasn't anyone there. It's just kind of a gate right now. You know, if you're not familiar, Strawberry Field was an orphanage, but also sort of this playground that John Lennon used to go to as a kid. And John Lennon was raised by his aunt, who used to hate that he would go over there and play as a kid. And that's where there's a line in the song, it's nothing to get up about, because it's him saying, look, it's not a big deal. I'm just a kid going to play at this playground. But because it was a playground for an orphanage, I guess his aunt didn't want him to be there. But really, it's just this big red cast iron gate with these sort of two pillars that say Strawberry Field on it. But just, I mean, like that's, and from there, we walked to John Lennon's house. His childhood home is there, and a couple of blocks away is where Paul McCartney grew up. I guess they're 2 years apart, so they didn't really know each other that much, but it's crazy to think that they really just kind of came from just a couple of blocks away from each other. Ringo came from a little bit of a different place, a different neighborhood. It was sort of a lesser neighborhood, I guess, of Liverpool. I don't know. I think George was significantly younger than everyone else, but But just this, and then even Penny Lane, you know, you go to Penny Lane and, you know, I expected these big signs, and I really expected that. That's the thing. They haven't really, and I mean this as a compliment, cashed in on it. I mean, yeah. It's here, and there are plenty. There's like a Beatles store if you want to go buy Beatles stuff. And there's like a Beatles museum if you want to go check that out. But aside from that, the places themselves are not these like really touristized destinations. I just think I just made up a word, but it doesn't feel cheap. It still feels authentic. Like at any moment you feel like Paul or Ringo could just walk by. And I respect that a lot. I liked it a lot.
But that big statue, I see everybody's taking pictures in front of the statue of the four of them. Where is that? Like a downtown?
That is a couple of blocks. That's sort of here near the docks. What's actually interesting is it's actually near an orange and white striped building. And I kind of, and it sort of stood out because it was sort of a brightly colored building. And I asked someone what that building is. Quick sidebar, but a different sort of movie if we're looking at it. That was the home of the White Star Line, which is where they came up with the plans and I guess designed the Titanic. And, you know, if you remember, Titanic had the Liverpool stamp on the side. Because it was a Liverpool product, and apparently this building, which is right next to the Beatles statue, just a couple of blocks from where I'm sitting right now, on April 14th, 1912, when it sank, a lot of people, like families, apparently hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people gathered around this building, all banging on the doors and windows trying to find out what happened to their loved ones. So just, it's interesting, every corner you walk to in this town has some sort of really cool history, and you know, this was a big place for people that came to America. A lot of people came out of Liverpool and then from Liverpool would go to America. So if you have descendants that came from Europe or from England, there's a good chance at some point you have a family member who stepped foot in Liverpool at some point, which is kind of interesting.
That's amazing. Can you and Patrick Stoner recreate the Titanic pose in front of that building?
If I can be Kate. That's a much funnier joke for anyone who knows Patrick Stoner. I feel bad for any of our listeners who don't know Patrick Stoner because you don't realize how funny that image actually is.
If you don't know him, do your research. All right. We have reviews in this week's episode, and we have three brand new reviews that we're going to rifle through really fast. Again, if you guys send us reviews, you can either go to the iTunes Apple page, the Apple iTunes page for Real Blend. We are now at 101 star ratings. I know. I haven't checked unless we've gone up one more. And then we picked up these three new reviews. This first one is from ChrisFish21, who says, listening to Sean, Kevin, and Jake is like hanging out with friends. I love their in-depth knowledge of film and their varying opinions about them. Keep up the great work. Woo! With an exclamation point, which I'm going to assume is a John Woo shout out.
I actually think that ChrisFish21 is one of our former guests on the show. I believe that's Chris Van Vliet.
Oh, really?
I say that just because he's a big fisherman and he has a fishing company called Woo.
Well, then that's a Ric Flair Woo.
It's probably a reference to, yes, because Chris is also a big wrestling fan, which I'm sure that's a reference to Ric Flair.
All right, that's a Ric Flair
review. He didn't tell me that he left a review, so I'm not entirely sure. But if it's not him, that's a really crazy coincidence.
And I love Van Vliet. We need to have him back on. Next one's by Joel McFarlane, who says, Real Blend is the real deal. And he says, this podcast is a, in all caps, must listen for any movie fans. Every week, I cannot wait to hear what Jake, Sean, Kevin, and producer Gabe have to say about their latest adventures in movie review world. Well, now that's ironic, right? Because Gabe has nothing to say about his adventures in movie.
Oh, he's got plenty to say once we stop recording. Yeah. Then you can't shut the guy up.
It. Right. Or text messages all day in and day out. Their passion and friendship shine through with every debate they have, and the online community that they have created is second to none. Keep up the amazing work, and Dunkirk in all exclamation points. The community is another thing that, like last night, there was a Fat Thor conversation on social that I believe at one point reached 150 to 200 replies. And I'm realizing,
was this on Twitter?
Yeah, on Twitter. How divisive the Fat Thor, like this is a deep rooted conversation of some people being really upset that they're using Thor's depression for punchlines, and other people really liking the fact that Marvel's going after or exploring PTSD in different fashions. And I'm realizing that this is a huge divide in the Avengers Endgame camp. And we've had this conversation on the show a number of times. But the community had a ton of fun last night sort of debating it under the Real Blend Twitter, which I thought was pretty entertaining. I chimed in every once in a while, but then I just let them sort of go with it because they were in depth in their discussion of all things Endgame.
So. Do you know who came up with the term blenders?
I think it was me.
Was it?
Was it me, Gabe? Yeah, Gabe says it was me.
Okay.
I like it. Okay, last one by Peabody79. This is a long one. Welcome to Real Blend. This is Pete, who we met at the Chicago meetup, who I called Chris.
Ah.
Because he says, a.k.a. Who,
and he changed his Twitter handle to Not Chris.
Not Chris. And every time I see it, I feel like such a tool.
As you should.
I'm doing that. Yeah, I do. A podcast that's not just a great show, but a great community as well. As a standalone podcast, you'll be entertained to the fullest. If you're into technical talk about film, you will quickly gravitate and relate to Kevin's enthusiasm and full geek out moments. If it's structure and attention to story detail you crave, then Jake's your guy with some of the most intelligent and exceptional insights on films I've ever heard. And if you just love everything about movies, Sean will always be that voice. Their collective knowledge
also
and passion
Sean's
for
there.
The and also and also Sean. The excitement and hold on, wait. Their collective knowledge and passion for the industry is palpable from their first episode on to the most recent. The excitement and entertainment value never slows. But what is best about this group is their 100% sincere friendship, their love for film, and their collective hand in bringing a group of strangers together via social media, all with the similar love for cinema and entertainment. Now, again, I'll point out, these people get together without us now. They're very happy to have a group where they can go hang out and talk film, and they discuss the podcast, but in general, they just debate a lot of the things that we talk about on the show. The community that has been created by this podcast is one of the best I've ever been a part of and exists because of their passion and our mutual love and respect for what they do. This is great. Thank you guys for everything. Jake, you're my guy, but I can't call out Solo name scene, so I'll just finish with Dunkirk. Signed, Pete, a.k.a. Nitro, a.k.a. Not Chris.
A.k.a. Not Chris.
Not Chris. See, if you hang out with us long enough, you get a fun nickname like that.
If you hang out with us long enough, we won't remember your name.
Yes. I knew he was Nitro. I got that part right. Talking points. I want to start with this broke shortly after we recorded our most recent episode, the Terminator Dark Fate trailer. Jake, let's start there because I'm not excited about this franchise. And I want to give every movie a pass. And later, when we discuss Aladdin, I will let you know that sometimes expectations set really low can help. But my expectations after this one seem really, really low. Was there anything in that trailer that told you this is going to be worth checking out?
I mean, it just for the sake of seeing Linda Hamilton and Arnold on the big screen together, like, sure, like, that's what piques my interest. But that first trailer just looked like all the other crap we've gotten from that franchise over the last, at this point, what, 15, 20 years?
Oh, yeah, it's about 20 years.
Going back, I mean, it's been almost 30 years since we got T2, which is crazy. But, I mean, honestly, when it comes to this franchise, James Cameron has lost all credibility in my mind. Because I feel like, tell me I'm wrong, I feel like no. Every time one of these movies comes out, he steps forward and goes, I'm telling you guys, forget the other ones. This is the one. I put my name on it. And it comes out and it's crap. And we all thought, once again, after falling for it again, well, he got Linda Hamilton to come back, so maybe, just maybe, we should believe him on this one. And his name's slapped all over it. And once again, he's saying, forget the other. The other ones didn't even exist. The other ones aren't even a thing. Forget those. Those are crap, even though I put my name on it. That's crap. This is the one. And it looks like crap. It looks like the same thing, dude. It looks like Genesis and Salvation. Actually, I didn't think Salvation was that bad. But it looks like all the other ones.
If he was directing it, would you feel any differently? I don't even know if I would. I kind of just feel like every story they could tell in this universe has kind of been...
Yeah, I mean, like, didn't we say everything we needed to say with Judgment Day? Like, isn't that kind of it? Isn't that sort of the end of the story?
Yes, I thought so. And they're doing what Halloween did, you know, in that they're literally saying we're just a sequel to T2. Mm-hmm. And that everything that happened in 3, 4, and 5, legitimately in canon... does not exist.
Right.
And I don't know, people are asking about John Connor, like, where is he? Where's Edward Furlong's character? What happens
could
to
John
Connor?
Could he be a surprise actor in it? Could it turn out that Edward Furlong's in it?
I mean, sure, he could be, but I don't even know if that makes me interested in it. I don't necessarily care. I just feel like we've seen it in these two previous ones.
He's 40 years old and still riding a dirt bike?
I'll say this much. Tim Miller did a great job with Deadpool. And I'm excited for him as a director. And when he came out at CinemaCon in Las Vegas and did the presentation for this, his enthusiasm for the franchise was palpable. Like, he was near tears because he was so excited to be given the opportunity to play in this sandbox. And he adores the first two movies. And he kept saying that he and Cameron have come up with a story that got both of them so excited. And I want to choose to believe that. But
did you see anything there? Any footage?
Yes. There's a scene that's shown in that trailer of what looks like naked Mackenzie Davis fighting police officers. We saw that sequence in full. And then we saw essentially the trailer, which was the fight on that bridge. And then Linda Hamilton shows up and shoots the Terminator out. So mostly that. But the scene we saw in full was like a young couple seeing one of those Terminator flares when they show up from the future and then going down to investigate it, finding naked Mackenzie Davis, and then the police show up and then she fights off the police in a pretty big, you know, action fight scene. And it looked okay, but it looked like most of the things you've seen in the Terminator franchise. Talking about franchises that are still clinging to life, Ridley Scott, now that Fox is in the Disney camp, is saying that he is still planning his third Alien prequel. And I believe you said to me the other day in London that you like both Prometheus and Covenant.
I like Prometheus. So, here's what I was saying. I love Prometheus. I like Covenant. But
okay, so you're on board.
I'm on board. The only thing that concerns me is, and correct me if I'm wrong, didn't we hear like a year or so, maybe more ago, that he said that the third Alien prequel would not feature the Xenomorphs?
I don't know. I don't remember. He says a lot.
He does say. He's like Tarantino, where he just sort of says things. Yeah. And very little ever actually ends up coming to fruition. I heard that. If that's the case, then no. I'm not interested in an Alien movie with no alien. But
I'm reading the details of this plot right now.
I'm all for it, man. I love the Xenomorphs. I think they're one of the greatest movie monsters ever. I think Michael Fassbender is really interesting in those movies. I think David is a really interesting character. And I'm really curious to see where it goes after he basically kills everyone from Covenant.
Now, he remind me of the end of that movie. He's kind of leaving with like a bunch of eggs, isn't he?
Yeah, he's leaving with a bunch of eggs. And doesn't he put everyone sort of in those cryo-sleep chambers? And then right as they're all falling asleep, they all realize that he's actually, because they thought he was the good David, but turns out
he's
the bad David, and he puts everyone to sleep, and then he goes off.
Okay.
Eventually, it's got to. The only thing is, I feel like it just keeps getting further and further away from Alien, and eventually, it's got to tie up. That's my only thing is, if you're going to keep making these movies, you have to bring us to the beginning of Alien. And I feel like as of now, he's given me nothing that says that we're heading in that direction.
No. In fact, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the thing that I still love about the initial Alien was how streamlined and tight-knit and claustrophobic the whole thing felt.
So maybe, I know Cameron, like, it's time to think of it less about, because I don't think we're going to find out anything about that ship that crashed on that planet. from Alien, and more about like, well, here's just sort of another universe where those creatures existed.
Yeah, well,
which I'm cool with. You didn't even like. Really, you didn't even like Prometheus.
No, I did like Prometheus, and I liked a lot of the big ideas that he brought up in Prometheus, and I just thought he flushed a lot of them away in Covenant. Like, I got really disappointed in Covenant. And but again, every time I kind of write Ridley Scott off, he comes back with something like The Martian, or something like Prometheus, which I thought was sort of above his pay grade. And then he mails in a couple of schlockers, but I'm not ready to dismiss him completely.
Covenant felt like him responding to people that criticized him for Prometheus. I felt like he got a lot of flack in Prometheus because it was promoted as an Alien prequel and the Xenomorphs weren't really in it. And a lot of people railed on him for that. And so it felt like he's like, okay, well, you want Xenomorph action? Fine, here. And he took away all the big ideas and just gave us really kind of big, loud Xenomorph action.
Well, and I don't want to sidebar too far off of this, but this is becoming a really dangerous thing that, we're traveling down of filmmakers responding to fan criticism. Because last night, I don't know if you paid attention, but the embargo lifted on Godzilla reaction. And everyone was like, too much Godzilla, like too much monsters. Like it's just bombastic monster battles. And that was like the reaction to the first Godzilla. It was like, well, not enough Godzilla. He doesn't show up until the last 30 minutes or somewhat. Now it's overkill. And then in another example, the Sonic movie is getting delayed because they show Sonic the Hedgehog and everyone's like, nope, don't want to see
that. That is a dangerous move. My biggest knock about the 2014 Godzilla isn't that they didn't show Godzilla enough. It's that when they didn't, the human characters are not that interesting. Like Jaws, I'm fine with not seeing the shark because Quint is fascinating and Hopper's fascinating. Just make your humans interesting enough to sustain me in between the places we see the monster. Aaron Taylor Johnson is not going to entertain me for 2 hours.
No, very true. And so one filmmaker who we know is not going to bow to fan influence, he's going to deliver his vision no matter what. We got new Christopher Nolan details shortly after we recorded in London. And it turns out his new film is going to be called Tenet, which I don't love. Not the best name in the world, but I don't really know what it means.
Oh, God, do we have to live with Kevin shouting that at the end of episodes moving forward?
Why does Nolan love his one-word titles? Interstellar, Dunkirk, Memento, Inception.
Insomnia.
If it's not a Batman movie, he's essentially going for one-word titles. Now, he again is kind of keeping a lot of details close to his vest or close to his chest, but he's saying that it's set in the world of international espionage. The, not necessarily a log line, but people who would claim to know what it's about is essentially that Nolan, instead of just taking over the Bond franchise, decided he would try to make his version of a Bond movie, right? That's what it sounds like. It's going to globetrot from 8 different countries. He's starting to line up his cast. He's got Robert Pattinson. I forget who else he's lured into this one.
John David Washington.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. John David Washington's lead in it, actually.
I think Michael Caine's going to be in it.
Yes, of course he is. It's a Nolan movie. So we don't know a whole heck of a lot about it, but it's starting to come together slowly. And now we know it's called Tenet, and we'll follow through. Gabe is sending me, the IMDb link. All right, let me see who else is in this thing.
Is it just me, or without Kevin and his puns, does this show move a lot faster?
That's not a knock at Kevin.
I love you, Kevin. Oh! That's not a knock at Kevin.
Do you know who is going to be
in Tenet? Oh my God, please don't.
Aaron Taylor Johnson. Yeah.
Oh God.
Robert Pattinson, Elizabeth Debicki, who was great in Widows and good in Guardians. Kenneth Branagh, who is in Dunkirk. Clemence Posey, who is in one of the Harry Potter movies. Michael Caine, John David Washington, I think you mentioned. And Aaron Taylor Johnson is who's lined up for the new Nolan so far. So
I'm in.
We shall see.
I'm in.
You're in.
I mean, but you know, the thing is too, is that like, you know, set in the world of espionage, like that could mean anything. Like his titles or his descriptions, initial descriptions of his movies are always so vague.
Right. And it'll probably involve some sort of time travel or a celestial bookcase.
Yes. God, I hope so.
He talks to Murph. Talks to Jessica Chastain from miles away. We both agreed, I don't know if this was on the show or if we talked in between recording that we were going to go see Aladdin over Memorial Day weekend before we recorded again. Jake swore that we would go out of our way to see Aladdin. And so during my 3-day weekend, I said to my family, I said, look, I have to go. Like, we're recording.
Oh, did you mean
Wednesday.
The new Aladdin?
The new Aladdin.
Oh,
yes,
we'll clarify next time, dude.
Will Smith is the genie.
Because I'm ready to talk all about Robin Williams.
Are you really? So I mentioned earlier that expectations being low can actually help your opinion of a movie. And I'm going to tell you guys, I really liked it.
Aladdin. That a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining. And even better than that, I liked Will Smith as the genie.
I'm hearing that too.
Parts that, this is what I don't understand. I literally saw the song and dance Never Had a Friend Like Me at CinemaCon. And when they just showed it to us, it felt so douchey. Like, it was like, this doesn't work. But in context, somehow, that scene, same scene, but it was just, it was good. It was better. And when he shows up for Prince Ali and they sing Prince Ali and he shows up for the first time as the prince, great. Just a great song and dance, great choreography, like huge colors, musical numbers. It's a little long. It gets a little slow, you know, it during parts. And I will say that A Whole New World, when they got to that, I was like, all right, well, this is going to be a huge number. Here we go. That felt like a bad cover. Like, that felt like a couple got up at karaoke who can kind of sing. And I think both of them are able to sing, but that number in particular just felt hollow. It felt like you were watching a high school version of, because they're on the magic carpet, it didn't look very realistic. But the rest of it, Guy Ritchie did an amazing job. The main city, Agrabah, is that how you pronounce it? Looks great. Like, it looks like they literally went and shot, you know, at this city, even though I know most of it's green screen. The kid who plays Aladdin is fantastic. The girl who plays Jasmine is great. And I really, really dug Will Smith as a genie.
That makes me happy. I will make a point, because I haven't seen Godzilla either, so I have some catching up to go. I've got to do whenever I'm back stateside this weekend.
Now, I'm not saying that it's great, you know, but I'm saying if you went in expecting it to be the train wreck, and we have said on the show a couple of times that it's going to be a disaster, it's better than that. The movie that
God,
is
I hope
not
they put
quite
that quote on the DVD box. I'm not saying that it's great, Sean O'Connor, real good. Right.
But if you expect a train wreck, it's not quite that. Let's talk the perfection, because both of us went into this with pretty high expectations, again, based on the
set
chatter.
By Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, Kevin did set them pretty high. Although now that I go back over it, I don't know if he just kept saying that it's really messed up. But I couldn't tell if that meant good or bad. But you went into it with high hopes. What was your takeaway from
I got to be honest, that first half, I was super, because it's sort of two movies. It's sort of divided into half. And at one point, it even kind of like pauses. And it's sort of like that's the halfway mark.
Well, tell people what it's about. Give them a rundown.
So essentially, it is about a former musical prodigy who, who left a very prestigious music school to go take care of her ailing mother. After her mother passes, she then takes it upon herself to try to return to this school and see if maybe she can sort of pick up where she left off, only to really find that she's kind of been, I mean, she's sort of welcomed, but also finds that her spot's been replaced. Like, she's been gone for a couple of years. They now have this new prodigy who's sort of this new amazing musician, and they spark up a very, very passionate relationship. But you can't help but wonder if maybe deep down, Allison Williams, who is the girl who went away and came back, maybe harbors this very deep-seated jealousy. And that's sort of the premise of, you kind of have to question her motives in this new passionate friendship/love affair that these two students develop as they venture out on their own into China together.
Yeah. I also thought it was, so with a movie like this, you kind of stick with it until the answers come.
Yeah,
right? Like,
you have to.
Okay, I'm going to give it a pass. And we'll get into this when we talk about Ma later. It's the same kind of deal. Like, it's a weird movie, but you have to sort of give it some slack until it starts to explain itself. And then either the movie's going to be really great because its explanations make a ton of sense, or it goes off a cliff and you don't believe anything. That's what happened to me with The Perfection. Like, once it got to a point where it was going to explain itself, I was like, oh God, really, this is what it is. But I even thought, like, leading up to that, it was kind of poorly made. Like, there are long sequences where the one character played by Logan Browning, who is the new student, is sick. And we have to kind of figure out why she's sick. But she's, like, violently sick. And there's a long sequence on a bus where they're trying to get her help. And it took, like, I was like, this is just clunky. Like, it's just poorly made and put together. And then there's two times in the movie, without giving anything away, where it literally uses the rewind as a device, like a visual device, where you skip back through everything that you watched, and then you watch the chunk of movie again from someone else's perspective. And that was never effective to me. I don't like when movies do that. That seems really lazy.
Well, it also reminds you that you're watching a movie.
That is exactly true. That takes you right out of the story. And then you kind of realize, all right, well, we got to get around to another explanation. Now, the good news is, and also, again, this speaks to, I think, what happens with Netflix movies when they're not made by the Corons and Scorsese's of the world. It felt like a TV movie. It felt TV size to the TV production.
It really felt like a TV movie to me in the back half. I got to be honest, that first half, and even up to that scene that you were talking about, the scene of her on the bus in China where she starts to get sick.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I realized, this is only halfway through the movie. Like, where the hell is this movie going to go from? You're like, she is just almost just ripping herself to pieces on a bus in the middle of a jungle in China. And we're only halfway through. Where do we go? And that's why I was so into it. And that's why I didn't even mind that scene being so long, because I kept thinking, we still have an hour to go. Like, this is just, if this is, you know, Kevin kept saying how nuts this movie is going to get. And I was like, if this is just an hour, where do we go from here? And then it kind of just went like, oh, that's where we go.
That's what it is. I'm going to ask you a question that will be, it'll make more sense to people who have seen it. And it's not quite a spoiler. But early on, when they first meet and they're at a party, someone else gets sick, right? And they talk about a pathogen, like a toxin that's reported at a village. But that doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't, no.
It never surfaces?
Other than, let's see, now I feel like, how do I answer this without getting into spoilers?
Just text me later.
Yeah.
Someone who is varying up what she's doing, and this is getting us to This Week in Movies, Octavia Spencer. So let's get into Ma, because neither of us have seen Godzilla 2, and we talked Rocket Man, but I want to get to Ma. Octavia Spencer has never done horror, and she's been telling people on the interview circuit that she took Ma as an opportunity to sort of challenge herself. Here's a three-time Oscar nominee, a recent winner. She won for Hidden Figures, is that right?
She won for The Help.
She went for The Help. Okay. So this is her with Tate Taylor, who made The Help. And they're both sort of trying out horror. And I went into this thinking that, like, they lean heavily into the body torture. Like, these teenagers they party at Ma's house, essentially. And Ma, you don't know why she's opening up her house to these kids, but it eventually goes south and becomes like a Saw type situation.
Oh, I did not realize that's the direction it went.
Well, I don't know if that's a spoiler. I think that's kind of in the marketing. But it becomes one of the things where you try to go with the movie for as long as you can because you want to know why Ma is doing this, right? And I will say Octavia Spencer is really good in it. She's very convincing, and she has a lot of fun playing the deranged person. But when you get to the explanation of why Ma is doing it, it's so dumb. It's so dumb and really disappointing. And the only thing I'm going to say
is... Can I guess what it is?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
How do I guess it without you?
And if you get it, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you that you got it right.
Is it a Friday the 13th situation?
Friday the 13th. How so? Like that she's a...
That she did like a group of teenagers do something to a kid she used to have. Therefore, she's taking it out on all the children.
I mean, that's close enough.
Like a Mrs. Voorhees, Jason Voorhees kind of thing.
No, but you're on the right track.
Okay, all right.
I'll say that.
All right.
Yeah. And the only thing I want to warn people about this movie, too, is because I don't think you should see it. I really don't think it's good, and I don't recommend it. But I want to say that they're lying to you in the marketing, because so much of the marketing is in the torture stuff that she does to the kids. Like, oh, you got to see what Ma does to these kids. That is the last 10 minutes of the movie.
Really?
That's it. And even when it comes, it's not rewarding enough. So... Not that good. Neither of us have seen Godzilla. King of the Monsters. We'll both go out of our way to try and check it out before next week's episode. We both have seen Rocket Man. Now, how much did we talk about it last week?
We talked about it pretty extensively. I think it was a pretty glowing recommendation, and we got pretty heated about our comparison between that and Bohemian Rhapsody.
I do love that we're at a stage where these classic rock acts, whether it be Elton John, whether it be the Beatles, there's another movie coming out called Blinded by the Light. I kind of wish Kevin was here because he's seen it, and it's powered by the music of Bruce Springsteen.
I've also seen it.
You saw that too?
Yeah, I saw it.
How is it?
Oh, it's fantastic. But it's not really about... It's more along the lines of like a Yesterday, where it's a movie that is very much about the music of one particular act. Without necessarily being about that person.
Yeah, not a biopic at all.
Right. It's not a biopic about Bruce Springsteen. It's about a guy who lives in a small town in England who is introduced to the music of Bruce Springsteen. And it's a true story. It's all about how it completely changed his life and really shaped who he ended up becoming as a person. Okay. And it's really, whether or not, you know, it's great because I like Bruce Springsteen. But what's great about it is it's a really wonderful testament to the power of art and, you know, how our lives can be shaped by movies or music or whatever the case may be. I dare anyone that listens to this podcast to see a movie like Blinded by the Light. And whether you like Bruce Springsteen or not is irrelevant, but not at least relate to the idea of being heavily influenced by something in pop culture.
Okay. I actually love Bruce Springsteen.
You're absolutely going to love it. The way that they represent him falling in love with the music by projecting the lyrics up on the walls, it's very well done.
Did they do a junket? How come you guys got to see it so early?
I think we were in LA for a different Warner Brothers junket, and I think Warner Brothers had just bought it from out of Sundance. And I think it was not just us, a couple of press members, but it was packed. There were a lot of celebrities.
No kidding.
In there. And I think a lot of people that really wanted to come check it out, I think they were just trying to kind of get the vibe and get the word of mouth. Because I don't think it comes out till later this summer, maybe.
It is. It's July or August.
And I think they wanted to get a gauge on, okay, we spent all this money in this movie. How do people actually feel about it?
Okay, good. A British guy learning about Springsteen. So you'll be back in England, I'm sure.
Probably,
to speak to him eventually. You know what they should do that junket is in Jersey.
That's the place.
Right? Do it at the Asbury Park.
Let's be honest. That's America's ass.
Yes. Yes, it is. All right. Speaking of...
For the reference, if you don't get it, I'm making a reference to the Born in the USA album cover.
Terrible. That is really... Yes. That is America's ass. We all saw Rocket Man. We talked about it in last week's episode. Make sure you go check out our opinion of that movie in last week's episode number 69. But we had the opportunity to hop onto Skype and speak to executive producer of Rocket Man and creative genius behind a number of great franchises, Matthew Vaughn. So here is our conversation with Matthew Vaughn on the Real Blend podcast. Dive into it right now. Guys, I just want to introduce Matthew Vaughn, the producer of the new Elton John biopic, fantasy musical biopic, Rocket Man. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
I have to ask, because it seems that Rocket Man kind of owes its existence to the Golden Circle and the relationship that you built with Elton John on that set. Is that fairly accurate?
Well, yes, in that being, I'd say that's like was a catalyst in a much bigger
role in life, you say, of Elton John. But I was lucky enough to work with him, and the whole thing started when I was asked. I just said, I remember reading about the Rocket Man being announced at Cannes, I think 3 or 4 years earlier, with Tom Hardy and Michael Gracie, and I was like, well, I can't wait to see it. When and what's going on? And then, you know, Elton and David was saying, well, look, everyone's asking us to make the PG-13. They're not offering us enough money. If we go R, they want to just cut us down to the bone. And I said, well, have you seen a Marv movie? It's exactly the sort of things I want to make. I want to make big, bold, entertaining, R-rated films. So I read the screenplay and loved it, and said, let's go to town. And then by that time, Gracie was doing Greatest Showman, so there was a director needed. I was tempted to do it, but I was committed to Kingsman, and I thought I'd bring Dexter in, and then got it all wrong. I also was saying pretty loudly to everyone, I really don't believe you can do a musical when the lead actor is lip syncing. I don't think anyone will ever buy a ticket to that. Cut to Bohemian Rhapsody making me look like a moron, but I did believe that, and I sort of still do. I think that's what makes this film so unique is Taron singing. You know, it's like, look, you know, like Travolta in Grease. You know, when someone connects to the songs and just belts them out like he does, it becomes a different thing. And I knew Taron could sing, and it was just a fun experience because, you know, to make a movie with a bunch of friends who you all respect and you can argue with, but know you're going to get through the arguments is you get to make a good film, which I think we have.
You know, I want to get to Taron singing because I don't mean this, you know, in any way as a slight towards Elton John, but there are arrangements in Rocketman that I, you know, love as much as the original compositions, maybe even prefer to them. And his version of your song, just the way he sat down and composed your song in the moment, you know, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it right now.
Good. I'm glad you are. That's what was designed. And a lot of the arrangements was done by the mighty Giles Martin, again, an old friend of mine that knew Elton through his father, George Martin. And but it was, you know, I worked with him on the Golden Circle, rearranging Cameo words up. And I remember having a lot of fun doing that. And he was just, again, having Sir Elton saying, just go for it, be brave, don't be scared of offending. You know, he said, I want you to push the boundaries and make me think. And Elton's having the same reaction, by the way. He's like going, God, I wish I'd done some of the songs in that way. You know, he was very impressed with it.
That's amazing. You know, the film has, because it uses this structure of the rehab and Elton, you know, being able to sort of tell those stories. When I talked to Taron at the junket, he mentioned they used the Man in Orange as their guide for the story. And I imagine that the act of sitting around listening to Elton tell story, like just fantastic stories. Like, did you get that experience when you were working with him on Golden Circle? And is that, can you, I can't imagine
next to him for 12 hours and, which we did, you know, we literally for 12 hours, well, there's a scene that didn't make the movie of him doing a duet with Julianne Moore singing, Don't Go Breaking My Heart. And I was just literally sitting on the piano during takes, dueting with him. And I can't play the piano and him giving me lessons saying, no, try it like this. And he was amazing and telling us the most funny stories. And, you know, when you're sitting there and he's recounting his times with John Lennon and Presley and the Beatles and Bowie, and you just sit there and it was like me talking about ordering a hot dog in New York. It was, you know, so laissez-faire about it, but at the same time, humble and funny. Just very, he's a very funny man.
Taron completely blows me away in this movie. I mean, I knew he was gifted, but I'd realize now that I just had no idea of what he's capable of. And I'm giving you credit, essentially, for introducing us to him in Kingsman. He had a couple of things before that. But what do you remember? I want to know.
First film.
Yeah. What do you remember about auditioning him? You know, what did you... You know,
he'd never done a movie before when he came in.
Oh, okay.
So, and he literally came in but he walked through the door and I've always said this. People say, how do you find these guys? I said, I just use my eyes. And so what you guys see on screen, I see when they walk through the door. And you just have to be brave enough that if you see someone's brilliant and it's obvious, cast them. And don't do the Hollywood thing of, yeah, he's brilliant, but he's not a star. So let's put someone in who's not brilliant and not right for the role. And then you make the movie and you've got, I'm not going to be rude, but there's, you know, how many films have you seen where, you know, famous actors have been miscast in the role and they, you know, the movie's terrible and they're terrible, but only because they've been miscast because, you know, they have cachet in the foreign sales market, how it used to be. So I just cast. I've always just said you're better off. I mean, actually, I didn't say it for Hitchcock and I'm so bloody tired. John Huston both said that, you know, directing is 90% casting, and the whole movie is all about the cast ultimately because they're the people, you know, who are bringing it to life and that the public are seeing in the role. So the public don't really, you know, they don't comprehend too much, you know, hopefully they don't, you know, whether it's the music, the lighting, the editing, all that stuff should just wash over them. But the thing they do notice is the acting.
Well, I think it goes back to all your old films, going back to Layer Cake and casting Daniel Craig in that role and the way that you were able to find
Daniel Craig, Jennifer Lawrence, I got told don't cast. Daniel, they weren't sure about. I mean, Statham, I mean, I could go on and on and on. It's sort of, I should have been a manager, actually, if I kept them all on my...
I read that, tell me if this is accurate, that you recorded Taron singing a few Elton John songs to show to Jim Giannopoulos. Is that accurate?
I did. What happened was, when we got involved in the film, we started financing it, everybody was a little bit snooty, even more so than I thought. And so I just said, look, Taron, I'm getting you down to Abbey Road because people have just got to see how you are more than the secret weapon. You are the X-Set missiles of all missiles once people hear you and see you sing. And then we did it, and it sort of backfired at first because everyone thought it was fake. They're going, yeah, that's not real. And I'm going, no, seriously, there's no auto-tuning, there's no editing, this is raw footage. And they just didn't believe it. He was that good that they weren't there, that you know, I was virtually having to get a Bible out and swear on it.
That's amazing. And I will say that the movie does throw itself into another gear in the middle of Saturday Night when he shows up, you know, and it's sort of...
For me, it's revolting. I remember when I first saw Grease and Summer Loving. It gives me, I don't know why, I get the same vibe from that scene as I did when I first saw Summer Loving as a kid. I think, is that the song, Summer Loving? Summer Night.
Summer Night, Summer Loving. I know the song you're talking about, when they're both singing their different versions of the date.
Yeah, I think it's Summer Nights, actually.
You handpicked Dexter for the project. Can you fill me in on what it was about Dexter that you knew was right for this?
I knew... The most important thing Dexter would do for the film is provide a safe, a cocoon of safety for Taron to really go for it and show warts and all a character that was, you know, very hard for an actor to go to the depths that he did in this film. And I just knew Dexter was the man to do that. I mean, Dexter, his sets are the opposite to mine. They're very fuzzy and warm and lots of love, and we have an expression that love, it's a lovey set. And I'm a bit more of let's get the job done and a bit more of a taskmaster than he is, but his style was definitely better for this movie than mine.
I kind of loved, too, when I sat down to speak to him and we talked about the theatrical experience, he went right back to That's Entertainment, you know, to talk about MGM and the big musical set pieces. And I can see that influence, you know, in so many of the scenes.
Definitely, and Busby Berkeley. And really, the movie I made everyone watch when I was putting it together was All That Jazz.
Right.
Well, I just thought that was a really important film for the blend of what I call realism yet fantasy at the same time, which is, you know, hard thing to pull off.
I find it amusing that you're about to compete against your old friend Guy Ritchie, who also has a big song and dance musical in theaters.
Well, I think it's more amusing for Guy as they rake in hundreds of millions of dollars, but and we hang on with our fingernails competing. But you know what? I find it very satisfying. I've been texting back and forth with him, saying, "Isn't it amazing? It's 24 years when we first met and tried to make Lockstock that." In England right now, we're the number one and number two movie, and we've sort of split the pot. And I was like, could you, if we sat there 24 years ago saying that actually back then we're just trying to get a job, but the fact that we even still have a job 24 years later is, I'm grateful and astonished, and I'm glad that we've both got careers still. It's sort of, well, you know, in this business, it's a long time to be, you know, 20, I mean, I'm getting old now, it's a real shame.
No, but I also think it's great that neither of you have been pigeonholed. You're allowed to expand the types of stories you're each able to tell.
Yeah, I think it's important. Otherwise, you stagnate, you know. And I look at some directors and they have them, you know, you look at some of the greatest directors, I'm not going to say the names, but you go, what happened to them? Where are they? Why are they not working? And I think it's very easy to stick doing the same thing again and again, because you probably get paid very well, but then your muscles don't grow anymore, and then suddenly someone's come in and stolen the territory. But I do, it's quite funny that we've got two musicals. No, as I said, we're both lucky, you know, but we both love what we do.
Is there an irony that you're going against a Dark Phoenix retelling when you almost circled that story for a little while too?
Yeah, well, it's more than irony. I just think it's a sign of, again, I'm getting old, because, you know, you start building these spider webs as your career, and then, you know, they get bigger and bigger and more entwined. But yeah, it is a bit odd. I was laughing going, this is sort of mad. I've got Aladdin on one side and Dark Phoenix on the other, and I sort of wish them both well, but at the same time, I don't want them to do too well, because then I'm really buggered. But I think there's room for all of us, and in England there definitely has been. So, you know, in America there should be as well.
What is your initial reaction to the feedback? The feedback to Rocketman has been off the charts positive, and, you know, people have been really responding to it with the early, you know, showing in theaters and word of mouth going. What's your initial reaction to all of that?
Relief, excitement, and sort of a little bit astonished, because I'm not used to it. Because I'm, as I said, everyone's already talking about awards and things. I'm like, oh wow, this is a whole new thing for me. You know, the ones that I've never really made a movie that the establishment have been that impressed by, shall we say.
Well, but listen, the establishment seems to be changing their tune. You see things like Black Panther get into the Best Picture race nowadays.
And it should have done. There's a lot of movies, because I don't get me started on this, because I get so angry, because I know how hard it is for those Marvel movies to be made, to, you know, consistently, and there's a lot of other big films that get ignored, but yet the craftsmanship to make those films is so much harder than these dramas that suddenly get all the awards. But I've always said reviews and awards sadly don't pay the bills, but you know, I wouldn't say no to some, but at the same time, you know, I'm just going to carry on trying to just be entertaining. That's my job.
I would love to get your opinion just on two properties that you have a close connection to, both Fantastic Four and X-Men. Are you one of the people who think it's creatively satisfying that they will be under the Marvel Cinematic Universe umbrella?
Yes, 100%. I think I actually always, as the man that produced the last terrible Fantastic Four, and I'll say that because I said it from day one, but no one listened to me. I think Fan 4 is, for me, it's the live action version of The Incredibles. It's probably the most, I think, commercially viable Marvel comic, and Kevin Feige will get hold of that and probably make a masterpiece. And the X-Men world, I imagine that might get put on ice for a little bit. I think it needs a little bit of breathing time. They've made a hell of a lot since First Class, if you think about it. And I imagine Fan 4 would be the thing I'd like to see them do next. And do it, you know, Disney and Fan 4 and Marvel is a really potent combination.
I also would love to see, you know, for them to sort of switch that up and become a period piece. You know, people always say the 1960s is a fertile ground to explore with the Fantastic Four, and it just feels like the way that they should go with it. So,
that's when it was. You know, that's what I did with X-Men, though. It was because when these ideas were born, and the sort of the Fan Four about the nuclear family and the dysfunctional family and the science. It's an easier time. I mean, it's harder. You know, superhero films in the modern world, it's and spy film, everything in the modern world is harder and harder to do because, you know, the technology and is all out there. You know, Iron Man suit just doesn't seem that far away anymore, does it? It's sort of odd, but Iron Man suit, when Iron Man came out, was awesome. You know, and that was probably late 60s, early 70s Iron Man. I don't know when that came out, but it's easier because it's an easier because the bad, you know, the black and white, everything was more, you know, black and white, you know, bad versus good. You knew what was back then, clearer boundaries and clearer horizons. So yeah, I love a period. Look, I'm just done another period movie. So it's fun. It's really fun. Cause it's really good fun.
And obviously, I'm not going to ask you for any type of spoilers for the prequel, but I am curious because when you branched off and created the Kingsman universe, you were really looking to create your own type of sandbox to play in, and you end up creating an original franchise that actually allows you to shift to a whole new time period, you know, and keep exploring that. So how exciting is that to be able to do that?
It's like a dream come true. When we came up with Kingsman, you know, singing that pub with Mark Miller sort of 7 years ago, it was a very much a thing of two fanboys getting drunk, lamenting about what's happened to spy movies. And then the more I've got involved in it, the more I just felt there's a, you know, was I planning a universe? No, but a universe is sort of, it's been like the Big Bang, that all these other ideas are coming and out of, I don't know where they come from, but I'm excited because the prequel is so different that for me, it was a whole new muscle to go off and develop, and I hope the public like it. I don't know. I mean, I'm very proud of it already, but it's very, very different. So some people, all the people who hated Kingsman will probably love it, and all the people who love Kingsman might go, what the hell has he gone and done? But hopefully we'll like it.
Different in tone or just different in style?
Different in every which way but loose, apart from an ape. No way.
Oh, come on. Now you got me intrigued. Yeah. I will ask you this last one and get you out of here on this one. And again, thank you so much for your time and joining us. But Taron has said, you know, the plan is to complete the story of Eggsy and Harry. And I'm wondering if that's still your plan and how hard is it to lock down Taron these days?
God, it's going to probably be a lot harder in the next, as it's, but you know, the journey began. You know, the thing about Kingsman, it's like any film. It always comes down to heart and the relationship of two people. And Eggsy and Harry's relationship needs to be concluded. It's been set up for the end. Of the last one was, you know, they've been sort of torn apart due to marriage and you know, various things. And now it's their last hurrah together. And then we'll see what happens.
That's fantastic. Mr. Vaughn, thank you so much for your time and continued success. I hope Rocket Man crushes all the records.
Do you know what? I just hope people, I really mean this, if I just think, you know, I'm the man that's not keen on musicals, and this is a musical that if you're not sure about musicals will make you, it's the most acceptable sort of what I call fanboy musical that fanboys could go see and go, hey, that was worth it.
Well, I'm a jaded critic who doesn't go back to the movies that often, and I'm going this weekend to see it again. Because first off, the songs have been stuck in my head for weeks now at this point. That's what happens with Elton's music.
He's a genius, and that's, yeah, he's a genius, and he wrote great songs, and yeah, I'm seeing it. Even my kids were like, Elton John, what's that? And now they've heard the music, and they're like, trying to learn it on the piano at the moment. The fact that that hasn't driven me crazy shows how good the songs are.
It's fantastic. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, and bye-bye.
All right, everybody, make sure you go see Rocket Man in theaters. There are a lot of great choices at the theaters right now between Godzilla, between Rocket Man, still going out to catch things like John Wick 3, Endgame. There are great interviews you can go back and listen to on our own podcast. We talked to Chad, obviously talked to the Russo brothers, and we thank Matthew Vaughn for hopping on and discussing all things film with us. That brings us to this week's Blend Game. We announced last week that we are playing Catherine Bigelow Blend, another great proponent of action and big screen cinema. To me, there's only one obvious choice, but I'll let Jake go first to see if he agrees with me. Yeah. There's truly only one choice that you can make when it comes to this, but let's see if we're on
the same page. It probably also depends on whether you're doing a favorite or best. Okay, so I'm going to...
And since we have not decided that for this show, ever...
We're 70 episodes in. I still don't know what we're doing. I still don't know how to play.
Whatever you want to do.
I'm choosing one that kind of falls into both categories for me, which is Zero Dark Thirty. I just think that is such a, like, Zero Dark Thirty is a perfect example of what true, amazing, perfected direction can do for a movie. I mean, mm-hmm. that movie is so perfectly constructed, and it just has her skill set all over it. I mean, from the beginning all the way to the end. I mean, if you think about it, even just the final act itself, you know, the whole movie was kind of just about like, oh, you know, they marketed it as come see, you know, the SEAL, was SEAL Team 6 take down Osama bin Laden. Yep. And, you know, that's really only the last 20 or 30 minutes. But even the first hour and a half of that movie is just so tight. I mean, I was just sitting there in scenes that were just conversations between actors, just biting my nails. It is so unbelievably well acted, unbelievably well written, unbelievably well directed. It is just, I think, one of probably the most more underrated movies. Even though I think it got a Best Picture nomination, and I think it was pretty well received in the awards season, I still feel like it kind of came and went and people kind of disregarded it after a certain amount of time. And I just think that that is Catherine Bigelow at her absolute best as a director. And whenever I think of you know, what movie I would point to exemplify why she is one of the best directors working today, I would point at Zero Dark Thirty.
Let me tell you why you're wrong.
you're going to say Point Blank, aren't you?
It got a Best Picture nomination. You're correct. Chastain got nominated for leading actor. It got a screenplay and an editing, and then it won one Oscar for sound editing. So it did do really well. And it's one of those movies that one came out, I think, like right at the end of December in order to qualify, and then sort of got pushed through this season. But you're right. It did do really well. We talk about this a lot in terms of movies that we pick as favorites and bests, and rewatchability is just one of the reasons why I can't do Zero Dark Thirty. It was one of those movies where as soon as it ended, I was like, that is a fantastic movie that I will never watch again. I just have no interest in it. I would choose for her, I even think it gets overshadowed by the work she did in Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker to me was a more effective, I was more invested in the characters in Hurt Locker than I was in the ones in Zero Dark Thirty. Regardless, but the siege, you know, that eventually ends the killing of Bin Laden is spectacular, spectacular filmmaking. Anytime I'm going to talk Catherine Bigelow, I have to say Point Break. Point Break is just to
I
me,
am an FBI agent.
And we rave about Keanu and how good he is. And yes, he's a little bit in those, in Speed, Point Break, you know, he's a little cheesy. He's a little overblown. I think the John Wick franchise fits him better because he's underplaying it a lot of times. And not that things are underplayed in that franchise. Like, I mean, people are getting killed left and right. But he's the center of it, right? Like, he's the gravitational pull that's sort of keeping John Wick together. And back when he was doing Point Break. But Point Break is just so... There's so many great action set pieces in that movie that we have discussed at length on this podcast. And it showed how great Catherine Bigelow is at filming action, right? How often do we talk about, like, when you get a lazy or inadequate action director, it's all choppy cuts and it's all, let me mask what I don't know how to do.
I feel like it's a lot easier to see bad action being directed than good action. Because if it's good action being, or if it's action being directed well, then you kind of forget that you're even watching a movie, period. As opposed to, it's much more apparent. It's much easier to call someone out for poorly directing action.
Well, and I know you're off the Fast and Furious franchise, but I do think that that franchise finds good directors who at least can stage good action set pieces. I think F. Gary Gray can do it. I think James Wan was able to do it. Justin Lin is very talented in that. Like, that may be an over-testosterone-y, you know.
But on the flip side, I'm excited for Hobbs and Shaw.
Because of how good David Leitch is, right?
And also, like, it seems to just be fully aware of what it is.
Yes. The year that Zero Dark Thirty lost, it lost to Argo, which I find pretty fascinating because that was, you know, not similar, but had a sort of political edge to it. But I thought put it in a more palpable package. So I have to go with Point Break. And I understand that even though he's on vacation, and I'm not even sure where Kevin is. Do you know where Kevin is?
He's on a cruise right now. Last I saw, he was actually in Alexander Hamilton's home.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's putting some stuff on social that he and Lauren are there. He recorded his pick. So let's throw it to Kevin, giving us his choice for hashtag Catherine Bigelow.
Jake, Sean, good to talk to you guys. I'm here with Lauren, my beautiful wife.
Hi.
And we are on a cruise. Where are we
currently in Antigua in the Eastern Caribbean Sea.
Yeah, we've been doing, we left on Sunday from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and we went to, what, St. Thomas, St. Kitts.
St. Thomas, St. Kitts, and Nevis. Now we're in Antigua, heading to St. Lucia and Barbados for the rest of the week.
And in Nevis, we went to Alexander Hamilton's home. Which was amazing. So, all right, so we're doing Catherine Bigelow blend. And I know she's made a ton of movies that we all love. So I'm going to let Lauren go first on her favorite Catherine Bigelow film.
I mean, this is just easy for me. Zero Dark Thirty, because Jessica Chastain in that film, I think she should have won all the awards for that performance because it was a very internal performance. And it's a story that we kind of saw from a different side with that character. So, I mean, I know Catherine Bigelow's done a lot like The Hurt Locker, and I think Jeremy Renner's amazing in that. But, I mean, like, just because Jessica Chastain alone kills it in Zero Dark Thirty, that's easily my pick as her best film.
And, Jake, I was just wondering if you'd heard about Jessica Chastain's favorite Michael Bay movie. And now I'm going to pause for an awkward silence while Jake gets angry. Jessica Chastain's favorite Michael Bay movie is Jessica Chastain and Gain.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was good.
So bad.
Sean, I know Sean's laughing. Jake's probably has his palms in his hands.
What's your favorite movie of hers?
My favorite Bigelow movie is probably Point Break. And that comes down to probably just a personal reasoning of that. I think the best movie she's ever made is definitely The Hurt Locker. But just because of the sheer tension of what she built with that film. And obviously Renner's performance was brilliant. So was Anthony Mackie. But Point Break just holds a special place in my heart because when I was in college, I was in a band called The Ex-Presidents, and that was named after the movie, obviously Point Break and The Ex-Presidents and the bank robbers. And my lead singer, Tim, went by the name of Bodie. So it just gave me a better appreciation for that movie. Also, I just think it's just Keanu Reeves in his element. He's amazing in that movie. And it's funny, like Keanu Reeves, I think he's a really great actor. I think that he gets pinned down to just the action guy from Speed. And I was talking to someone the other day. I was like, and I forgot that Reeves did Shakespeare. He did Much Ado About Nothing. Mm-hmm. The guy has an amazing filmography. Patrick Swayze is incredible, clearly. That movie is just so well done. It's very 90s, but a lot of fun. Very classic action. Very, very fun character development. And you just genuinely love the relationship that kind of builds between Swayze and Keanu Reeves and that tension of the, you know, being undercover and things like that. And I think a lot of people compare Fast and Furious 1 mm-hmm. to Point Break.
Did you ever see the remake?
I saw the remake. Yeah, it was not good.
Point Break remake?
It was, the stunts were cool, but the story was not great.
Yeah.
But the, yeah, so that's my favorite Bigelow movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so I think that I also read the other day Patrick Swayze. He's been, that movie particularly was that bigger than Dirty Dancing for him?
I don't know. I mean, for females, no.
Dirty Dancing was like his ultimate?
I think all of my girlfriends, I can't.
He passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah. Not
sad.
Terribly long ago.
Yeah. Well, obviously the cool thing about, I always say this in regards to, actors and musicians, anybody who passes away, that their work lives on forever. I mean, I'm sitting here right now on a cruise ship in the middle of
the Caribbean
talking about Patrick Swayze and a movie he made in the 90s. So that's my favorite one. Jake, Sean, I miss you guys and love you guys. And thank you for letting us check in from the cruise.
Miss you and love you too.
Yeah, and we'll talk to you guys next week. I was trying to think of another pun before I went. And I'm trying to think of how I wanted. I don't know. I can't think of one.
You're in vacation mode.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. As for audience picks, Zero Dark Thirty was chosen by Danny Gurch, Chase Cusack, of course, and several others.
Chase and I actually saw it together in New York.
Did you really?
He sat next to me. He breathed really loudly. That's what I remember about watching it with Chase.
That's the story he wants you to share. That he breathed really loudly.
He was a loud breather. It was like a Seinfeld episode. He was a loud breather.
Alex Auerbach, Martin Quibble, and many, many others, of course, said Point Break. So it seems like you and I went with the two most popular ones. I do want to throw out Strange Days, an early film by her.
I've never seen it.
Really, really good. It's really good. You should check it out. And basically, I just think she needs to be making more movies.
Yeah.
Where has she been?
She did Detroit.
How is she not? Oh, right. Which I never saw. Did you ever see it?
Did. I actually liked it.
Did you?
I did. I mean, it's a very difficult movie to watch. It's not by any, you know. But I thought it was very, very well done. And once again, kind of just got brushed away. I know a lot of people that didn't like it.
One of those ones that feels like it's there on Hulu or Netflix or one of those ones that pops up. I'm always like, oh, I should watch that now. And it just feels like homework. And it's not what I want a movie to necessarily feel like. For next week, partially because we were talking about The Terminator, partially because we were talking about Alien, we're going to go with a larger genre. And we're going to play hashtag sci-fi blend. Have we ever done sci-fi blend?
I don't think so.
I don't think we have. Well, we're going to do it for next week. So you got to think big picture and come up with hashtag sci-fi blend for your favorite because Gabe says always favorite sci-fi movie. And let us know your pick via email, realblend@cinemablend.com. Of course, you can go to the Twitter page, realblend, and you can play #sci-fi blend and give us your picks. We'll be back to record a new episode next week. What are we talking about next week? One of the movies that are opening. Oh, Dark Phoenix. We can finally start talking about Dark.
Yeah, Dark Phoenix will open. They pushed back Late Night a week, so I think we got to hold off talking about Late Night. Okay. But honestly, by next week, we would have seen... I do think we'd need to both go see Godzilla and talk about it.
Are we... Gabe, you want me to announce who we're going to have on the show next week? I guess we can, right? All right, I'm going to put this picture up on social, too. But in next week's episode, we will have the first part of our conversation, and this will be a spoiler-free conversation of all things X-Men with our good friend Ty Sheridan. And of course, you know that if Ty Sheridan is on the Real Blend podcast,
yeah,
we're going to talk Ready Player One with him also.
And Kevin brought up something to him in the interview. I'm not sure which part it is.
Yeah.
A really interesting connection between his role as Cyclops in the X-Men films and Ready Player One, which was right in front of us, and I never even thought about that, and it blew my freaking mind whenever he brought up this connection. It was fantastic.
It really did. And I think when he said it out loud that he didn't realize it either, and all of us were just like, oh my God, you're 100%.
Oh my God. Right. How did we never see this?
So that is an excellent tease for our first part of our interview with Ty Sheridan next week. So listen, join us back here next week. In the meantime, go to our socials. Give us a follow at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy, and at Sean_O'Connell. Of course, you can also drop us a review on our iTunes page. It means a whole lot to us. Helps us grow the show, of course. Send us an email review if you're not on Apple iTunes. realblend@cinemablend.com. We will read them at the top of the show. We'll be back next week. And, you know, Jake, Kevin's not here. So we basically have to end it the only way that... Is this the episode where we don't end it with Dunkirk and we end it with Solo name scene? All right, 3, 2, 1.
Solo name scene!
Happy birthday, Michelle.